Hi, David Daly. Welcome to KABU in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
David Daly is a senior fellow for Fair Vote. It's an organization that describes itself as, I quote, a champion of electoral reforms that give voters greater choice, a stronger voice, and a representative democracy that works for all Americans. My sense is that this is intentionally modest because many of the reforms it advocates, like ranked choice voting especially, that reform has powerful radical consequences. David Daly is an activist. He also wrote two notable books, RadX, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. The first word, of course, is unmentionable on the air. It helped spark the recent drive to reform gerrymandering. Dave's second book, Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy, he's a media favorite, lectures, does interviews, has prestigious academic and organizational affiliations, articles, and a great number of left and genuine liberal publications, including The Guardian and Rolling Stone. One final biographical item, when working for the Hartford Courant early in his career, he helped unearth Deep Throat, whose revelations contributed to Nixon's downfall. We're going to discuss Trump, his forces, and his ominous moves to extend his presidency, maybe create mayhem in the coming election, that won't be too hard, then call in the police and army to restore law and order, so that we can prepare for another election as he consolidates his power, and another election that will only come when he is in charge of it. Dave, tell us about Fair Vote, especially its advocacy for ranked choice voting.
Sure. Well, I mean, exactly as you described, Fair Vote is a nonpartisan organization that works on behalf of electoral reforms that give voters more voice and more choice. Our main focus over the years has been ranked choice voting, which just would be such a profound reform when it comes to cutting through the polarization and extremism and dysfunction in our government and really trying to elect not only a more proportional and fair delegations from states and in state legislatures, but also to re-incentivize politicians to try to solve problems and to incentivize them not to run towards their base in uncompetitive districts and the summer low turnout primaries, but really to have to talk to all of the people again. It would go a long way towards fixing things, and the reform has really been gaining powerful momentum. I mean, it's been adopted statewide for almost all elections in Maine. It'll be on the ballot this fall in Massachusetts and also in Alaska. And New York City is going to be voting on charter revisions that will enact ranked choice voting for all of New York. You're also seeing it, you know, in Utah and in Indiana and Virginia. Conservative states, liberal states, big cities, small towns are all realizing this is a better way to hold elections.
Yeah, for me, it makes it possible for people to vote for what they really want and for third parties, especially people who I identify with on the left who find themselves trapped in lesser evilism, that you have to vote for Biden, but you would rather vote for the Greens. Well, you can, in ranked choice voting, you can vote for the Greens in second place. And even if the Greens don't win the ranked choice voting, the votes in second place would then go to Biden. So we're not faced with this always this terrible dilemma in these winner-take-all districts. So much of a better conversation in, let's say, San Francisco that does it. Wonderful sort of way of being able to discuss with voters the alternatives that are actually possible in American life.
I think that's exactly right. I think really, the most powerful thing about ranked choice voting is that it essentially requires that a candidate win with 50% of the vote. It puts an end to these plurality winners that, you know, sometimes as less as you know, in a Republican primary in Tennessee last week, 21% of the vote for the winning congressional candidate there in Tennessee's first district. That means 80% of the people essentially wanted somebody else than they're going to get. If you go back to 2000 in Florida and Bush versus Gore, this is probably the ultimate example in some ways of the power of ranked choice voting. You had, according to what was authorized as the final vote, George W. Bush beats Al Gore by about 500 votes in Florida. Ralph Nader, running as a Green, collects, you know, in the low six figures. So clearly, a majority of voters in Florida did not have George Bush as their first choice. If you'd used ranked choice voting, all of those Nader voters would have been able to mark a second choice. And if nobody had won 50% of the vote, which nobody did, you would have essentially had an instant runoff. And those votes for third-party candidates, instead of being spoiler votes or votes that get in the way of majority will, would have gone to the second choice candidate. What we are seeing increasingly in this country is really large fields of candidates, right? You had 17 major Republicans running for president in 2016. You had about 25, 26 Democrats, serious candidates running for president in 2000. When voters are presented with that many choices, choosing one is insufficient. It does not give you an accurate read on sort of where public opinion and the public will actually is. A ranked choice voting gives you that.
Dave, let's talk about the current election and Trump's, for me, threat to democracy. It seems to me very clear that the self-called alt-right includes avowed white supremacists and neo-fascists. Trump has called them good people when they marched in opposition to a civil rights march in Charlottesville. The alt-right groups have carefully studied the Nazi route to power. It's on all of their reading lists. And Trump seems to have absorbed the basics of that strategy. He surely wants to keep power to extend his presidency, and he's often voiced his admiration for dictators, presidents for life around the world. Perhaps this is alarmist, but it appears to me as events unfold, there's little that disconfirms these fears. And one thing I'm pretty sure of, Trump has little to lose by going for broke. And maybe he even have dreams of running in 2024 after an unsuccessful Biden administration. What's your sense about the Trump threat that a lot of people are writing about Trump's machinations?
There's a very real threat of this election spiraling into chaos and creating the kind of constitutional crisis that we haven't seen in this country, certainly in my lifetime, and I think it would be without a lot of other historical parallels. Some of this, I think, comes from the unique threats and willingness that he has shown to flout traditional norms and behaviors in the middle of elections. Some of it comes from a pandemic that is going to make voting more difficult and more challenging than it has perhaps been in this country any time since maybe the Civil War. And some of it comes, I think, from what has become a really pitched battle, especially in states and state legislatures, over how easy or hard it should be for citizens to cast a ballot. There are a number of states that have made it dramatically easier. They've adopted things like online voter registration or automatic voter registration or no excuse absentee voting or expanded multiple days of early voting, given people vote by mail options, opened up drop boxes. And then you see a number of states that are tightening those excuses. And they're saying, no, you have to present a voter ID, or we're going to very carefully purge voter rolls. We're going to, you know, close precincts. We're going to make it harder for people to register to vote. We're going to eliminate days of early voting. We're going to require more excuses or a witness or a notary if you want to vote absentee. All of this is going to collide on November 3rd in a way that I don't think anybody can fully say that they understand exactly how this is going to come out. You're going to have states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, the states that determined the election last time, these states are going to have probably 70%, it's been estimated, of all of their votes be counted over mail. Most of these states have had maybe 10, 12% of the vote done by mail in the past. So this is a massive undertaking to receive all of these votes, to open all of these votes, to count all of these votes. And I don't think states are necessarily prepared for this. And then when you factor into this a deeply partisan media that may well be calling states before they are done, when you factor into this a president who may be willing to take to Twitter and declare victory in the middle of the 2 or 3 weeks that it could take some of these states to actually come up with results, when you factor into this the kind of court battles that are likely to make Bush versus Gore seem like child's play, this is deeply, deeply uncharted water. And I think everybody who is thinking seriously about it is right to be deeply concerned.
Yeah, what about Trump's dog whistles, that is, suggestions to his forces that are sort of coded, but everybody knows what he means. When he was trying to stop lockdowns in states to stop the pandemic, and he managed to actually succeed to a large extent in stopping the lockdowns, which are going to kill probably over 100,000 people. When he was campaigning to stop the lockdowns, he did these dog whistles to his Second Amendment people, he calls them, or the vigilantes, and, you know, the men who love guns, some women too, to go to the state houses and show their dedication to their guns and to the American freedoms to infect other people if they want to. They did show up at state houses, and we saw these pictures of sort of frightened state troopers standing up to this camouflaged battalion of guys with more firepower than the troopers had. I have a sense they're already primed, I think, to go onto the streets if the election is sort of delayed, if the TV news networks say, oh, Trump has won, he's won the swing states, another great surprise, even as the ballots, are, of course, are being counted. And then if it goes to the Supreme Court, they might affirm the Gore-Bush decision, claiming that all this mayhem in the streets and the problems, Americans are frightened, we have to stop this, so we're declaring Bush the president, which is what they did. And then Gore, of course, had the grace to step down. Trump will never step down, is my sense. It seems to me that that recipe for the creation of a long-time Trump stranglehold on power in the United States, especially, of course, with the army, assists the police in restoring order, and certainly the governors of Republican states are going to invite the army in, which they have a duty to do under the rules of the country when the governor asks them. It seems to me extremely dangerous, and we're going to have, as you pointed out, going to be a long time between the actual count, a real count of the votes, and the end of the election. It could stretch into December and January, especially with all of the lawsuits. I think those possibilities are really strong, and we seem to be marching right into it. How do you evaluate those fears?
Sure. Those are serious fears. You know, I mean, it's certainly a scenario that people have posited. Listen, I think it's really dangerous to talk about and intentionally try to undermine the legitimacy of elections. And it feels as if, you know, that is certainly happening. What you have is a president who's more than willing to go on Twitter and sow doubts about the legitimacy of elections, and who has been willing over the years to make all kinds of, you know, demonstrably false claims about voter fraud. This is back in 2016, claiming that he would have won the popular vote if not for, you know, all kinds of people from Massachusetts being bussed up to New Hampshire or something like that, and a lot of the myths that were at the heart of the Kobach-Pence commission back in 2017 that was ultimately disbanded without finding any proof of voter fraud at all, up until this campaign in which, you know, this year in which he's been more than willing to spread falsehoods about vote by mail. And when you sow this much doubt and dissension and try to undermine the credibility of elections, and when that meets a pandemic, when it meets the possibility of these decisions not having an answer on election night, yeah, I think all kinds of things that we might find extremely awful could happen during that period. They may not happen. But I certainly think we need to be alive and alert to the possibilities. We think 2020 has been a long year already, but, you know, I mean, November could still have some fresh historical hell in store for us.
Dave Daly, it was really great talking to you. Thanks a lot. We'll talk again.
Pleasure to be here. Anytime.